Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. A special session on partisan gerrymandering is postponed, but not adjourned. Plus, a legislative committee questions DPI meetings. And another Senate Republican says he won't seek re-election. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 17th. I'm Anya Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Big week this week. We had the special session on partisan gerrymandering, which obviously went off with huge fireworks. Just kidding. Nothing happened. So on Tuesday, we all kind of went to the Capitol. I think we had some sense that a deal had not been reached on this proposed constitutional amendment from the governor. And sure enough, we started getting statements from Republican leadership that they were leaving the session open. So there is potentially some hope there. But they did not do anything Tuesday. They they postponed for Thursday, re-postponed again. So they're not adjourning. But what does this all tell you? What do we know and what do we not know so far?
Republicans are looking for a way out of this that they find acceptable. So now a little fun fact for everybody at home from the Reference Bureau, wonderful people over there. The governor's called 14 special sessions since he became governor 7.5 years ago. Six times, folks have gabbled in and out in one day. So that tells you most of the time they come in and go, we're done. Here's an interesting situation where I get the impression that a vote to just gavel out redistricting, would it look great? But I don't know they really want to do something to give up power on redistricting. If you look at Devin Lemahue's statement, he talked about this as a core legislative function. Like, I don't get the impression that Senate Republicans want to give up that power and hand it to a commission. There are all sorts of questions about this. Remember, the governor, when he signed this executive order, there's an amendment that all it says is partisan gerrymandering is banned and these districts shall not have a partisan advantage. How do you define that? Who's going to judge that? What's the mechanism? How do you draw the maps? Who's going to draw them? All kinds of unanswered questions.
If
now,
you want to then challenge based on that language, what type of court does it go to? Oh, it goes to a liberal-controlled Supreme Court who will interpret what those words mean.
Oh, you're putting that standard into there's all kinds of questions. But so here we are with this big, giant question out there, and Republicans going, okay, what do we do? Now, I can see a scenario from talking to people where Robin Voss and Republican Assembly have some proposal, but if they want to work out a deal with the governor, that should be a conversation. The governor said they have not talked at all and says there's nothing to negotiate about. Not usually a winning combination to get a deal done in the Capitol, but just from my experience.
Yeah, historically the Republicans don't love to be told what to do by Governor Tony Evers. But what he did say in that statement as well was that, you know, not going on the record by holding a vote is essentially like a vote against or a vote for partisan gerrymandering. And so I think he is trying to get some sort of statement on the record. And, you know, you mentioned the gavel in, gavel out process. Weirdly, I have only covered two special sessions, neither of which were gaveled in, gaveled out. The other one was on child care, right, which is another one of these issues that voters really deeply care about. And so you don't want to be seen as kind of not treating it with seriousness and gravity. But we've also heard from Robin Voss, especially, who has said, you know, outlawing partisan gerrymandering is still a way of using demographics for redistricting in a way that isn't appropriate. And so it does seem like they're in really different places. And then Devin Lemmy, who says, well, we want public input. So they seem miles apart on this issue so far.
Here's a really fun dork fact for you about sessions, okay? Lobbyists can't donate to campaigns until the sessions are over. So I'm bringing that up because I think there'll be an end at some point. The regular session technically ends, I believe, in mid-May. So after that ends, they can start writing checks to campaigns. But they can't if the special session remains in session. I would get just a hunch that by the time the regular session is actually over, that this will be resolved. Now, again, what's it going to look like? I don't know. They keep just like pushing it off, recessing until people forget about it. We'll see. But just watch that mid-May date for something to happen.
That is fun fact that I did not know either. There are other negotiations also ongoing, which is the sort of property tax and school funding negotiations. We've been talking about this for months. It also doesn't seem like they've made a whole ton of progress on that either, but there have been sort of like allusions to the fact that they do want to work something out. So again, what do we know? What do we not know?
The parameters have been there for weeks, right? So the governor wants education funding, special education. He wants property tax relief. Some Republicans want property tax relief. They want stuff like no tax on tips and overtime. Some Republicans want rebate. Democrats in the legislature are kind of like, hey, wait a second. That's $2.5 billion. If we hold on to that, we might have a trifecta come January. We could have a lot of money to play with for our priorities. So the question is, one, does the governor and Robin Voss and Devin Lemieux reach an actual deal? The conversation has been ongoing. They're not as intense, which is the word that Robin used in a social media post the weekend, as some would suggest. It's kind of more like they talk every week or, you know, so often what's going on, and they're making progress. The second part is getting Republicans back in the Capitol. I know you might sound odd. We're a full-time legislature. But once they recess or adjourn, they scatter. And they don't have the same – it's not like spring break for school where they all go out the same week. They've got vacations and family commitments, and they're doing stuff. Oh, by the way, the window of the nomination papers open on Wednesday, so they're gathering signatures or run for office again. You're likely going to get maybe a couple of Democrats in each chamber at best to vote for whatever comes out of it, right? So there are a couple of senators, for example, the Democrats who – have shown willingness to kind of vote like they were in a swing district. In the assembly, three or four have like tough races this fall. It would help them to vote for a tax package. But I wouldn't count a whole lot of them right now. So that means you have to get every Republican back. Now let's remember, we've got a lot of retirements going on. Not a lot, but you know, they're starting to come. You've got some dissatisfaction in the Senate GOP caucus about like how the session ended, what bills made the floor, what bills didn't. It's kind of like a logistics problem right now to get everybody in the chamber to vote for a bill that they want. And oh, by the way, how much for rebate are these guys going to get over here? How much for property tax relief? How much for schools? There's still some things to be worked out.
Right. There's a lot to game out. And, you know, the three men whose faces were just on the screen, Evers, Lemieux, and Voss, none of them are going to be around come January. Mm. And so there's also a lot of questions about who will be in charge and who to whom do people need to kind of be capitulating at this point? Speaking of education funding, there was also a hearing this week on how DPI used money to hold a meeting. So this all kind of goes back to the new testing standards that were rolled out in 2024, and then there was this retreat in the Dells to sort of review what tests should look like. Republicans say that that meeting violated open meeting laws. They say it cost way too much money and that it led to standards being dumbed down. DPI says it actually shouldn't have been subject to open meeting laws because it was a meeting of educators. It wasn't a quorum of public officials. So let's start by taking a look at the video of what this committee hearing looked like.
It's pretty mind-blowing to spend almost $400,000 on a conference for 88 people and a vendor. Can you speak to these numbers at all?
The reality is your own colleague, and who is the esteemed co-chair of the Joint Committee on Finance, or the Joint Finance Committee, depending on which practice you adhere to, is, you know, reviewed this extensively after a delay for review and deemed it to be a routine state conference. So I don't think, while these charges may seem in isolation, in a vacuum, out of line, we priced this contract overall, and we are currently paying less than almost every state in the country at $30,000 per grade level for total services. Yes, these are individual items in that, but the aggregate is per grade level for testing, we're paying about $30,000 per grade level.
With all due respect to my esteemed colleague, I'm in disagreement with him on what this being an appropriate amount to spend, given the fact that we get to $8.2 million on this cost, and only one-third of the kids in the state can read at grade level.
Right, so there has been this sort of ongoing political battle over DPI as an agency, over school funding, over how that funding is used. What do you think is going to come out of this?
Good question. The chair, Nandweski, is really kind of exercising a power that some Republicans want lawmakers to do more of, which is oversight. We really haven't seen many committees exercise or do with this kind of an exercise, pulling committee agencies in. Really, it's been DPI has been the kind of target for the most part for the last 6 months or so because of various things like this. The teacher grooming stuff after the Capitol Times investigation, they've gotten the brunt of it, but there are others who want them to do more stuff. We saw it with a select committee in the Senate with Josh Call and DOJ and hiring private counsel with private funds to help with environmental cases. So we're kind of watching to see what goes from here in terms of like this oversight. And then two, kind of crux of the DPI defense was, hey, Mark Bourne, the co-chair of finance, told the WisPolitics that this was normal, that they looked into everything, they were okay with it, and released the money that DPI wanted for something that was being held up. And Amanda was like, I don't agree with Mark. Like, there's definitely a faction of Republicans who want to be more aggressive with DPI about this very thing.
Yeah, and so that'll, I think, again, be one of these issues that will continue to play out, especially in election year. Speaking of election year, federal fundraising numbers came out this week. Some really interesting results in the sort of contested districts. So in the third, which is probably the only really contested congressional district, Rebecca Cook significantly outraised Derek Van Orden, $2.4 million raised, and she now has $4.2 million cash on hand. He raised $1.3 million and has $3.8 million cash on hand. What does that tell you?
Okay, so number one, being an incumbent, being outraised by a challenger, not good. Not good happens back-to-back quarters. Really not good when she outraises you by $1.1 million. Like, that was eye-popping. Now, let's not forget, Rebecca Cook still has a primary. There's Emily Byrd, for example, who is the Eau Claire Common Council president. So running, she raised six figures. I hate to diminish that, but that's not what Rebecca Cook is doing. She's raising big money. Also, what's going on here is the effort by Republicans to try and undercut the image that Cook is portrayed of, this waitress who grew up on a dairy farm. She worked as an operative. She was a fundraiser for Democrats. There's nothing wrong with that, but it kind of conflicts that image of like this, you know, down-home local girl doing good. She was working even like last year, I believe. I got paid for working as an operative, as a consultant. So the Republicans want to keep chipping away at that. The thing is, though, like, the money spends the way the money spends. I don't really care where you get it from most of the time. I haven't seen any candidates lose because, oh, I raised money, too much money, or I raised it from out of state or whatnot. So this is not good for Van Orden, especially with the environment that we're seeing. Now, to Van Orden's credit, he's got this reputation where he's kind of gruff. You need to watch his Twitter feed with, you know, who's watching over your shoulder. It's not safe for work sometimes. But he is getting out more in the district more often. You're seeing more posts of like local media covering him talking about farm policy, no tax on tips, or doing like visits to senior homes. So he knows he's got an image problem and he's trying to do something about it. I don't know with the environment we're looking at right now, and I stress right now because it's not November yet, with that and the money and everything else, it could be a really tough environment for him come fall. Even though his seat leans Republican, he is the only member of the GOP delegation in Wisconsin, incumbent, who underperformed Trump in 2024. Trump drives a train in that district. Trump's not on the ballot this fall, and Van Orden underperforms. That's not a great combination. But again, we're not there November yet, so just we'll see.
Well, we do often see some of that kind of mudslinging about outside money coming in, although, of course, no matter who you are, you depend on outside money if you want it to be any amount whatsoever. And so when we look at the GOP race for the 7th, and there are Democrats running there, but it's a Republican district, and so we kind of look a little bit more closely at what's raised there. Again, lots of outside money coming in for a number of candidates. So there were a couple sort of like notable things, one being that Michael Alfonso continues to raise quite a bit of money, potentially with some help from his famous father-in-law. Wasgren gave himself $1.7 million. What else kind of jumped out to you from this?
Yes, the Wasgren money, it really is kind of a bookkeeping move, kind of like he moved money around. When you're wealthy and you're a candidate, some of this has happened. So those bars are kind of misleading because he raised about $4,000 from individuals. Like, Alfonso raised more from individuals than his other challengers combined, okay? That's not great for them. So if Paul Rosgren and Kevin Hermaning keep writing checks, okay, you know, that might help. But what you're seeing is Michael Alfonso benefiting from Sean Duffy's network and Donald Trump's endorsement. Like, that's reality. You do not see first-time candidates who are 26 years old in a northern Wisconsin seat getting PAC donations from Southwest Airlines normally, or from road-building industries, or from multi-millionaires from Texas. That's not usually what happens. But if you are Sean Duffy's son-in-law, you have access to Sean Duffy's connections, which help you a great deal. Now, for critics, this is like pay-to-play. They're all trying to like help Duffy's son-in-law. Politico did an analysis. I think 1 in 4 individual donations to Alfonso came from the from companies who were linked with the Trump administration or transportation. So they're trying to like suck up to Sean Duffy, but it spends the same. There is some pushback in the district, though, about Alfonso not going to events, like debates. He's doing events in the district about his age. about his connections, but if you add up Trump and the money, how do you overcome that, especially when it's a slog for these other guys to raise money right now from individuals?
Yeah, it's also kind of an interesting case study in the fact that Alfonso is one of these sort of younger, more online talking points kind of Republican in this district that has historically been a little bit more about relationships and connections, right? Tom Tiffany has been there forever. And so that'll be also interesting to see kind of how he competes with the more traditional ways of campaigning. So that'll be really interesting to watch. You alluded to retirements in the legislature this week. And we have Jesse James has officially announced that he is retiring, and Howard Markline officially announced that he is not retiring. So what does this tell us about where the Senate's at right now?
First, Jesse James, so remember, maps drawn in 2024 and put in place. He was elected to the 23rd Senate District in 2022, but drawn into the 31st with Jeff Smith, a Democrat from Brunswick. Jesse got a residence in Thorpe, which is in the 23rd. But he kept his home in Altoona. There's a story in the fall where there were a number of Republican lawmakers who had new residences, but their spouses were voting from their old houses, which kind of raised questions. Were they really living in the district? Okay, but for Jesse, all resolved, he's going to run against Jeff Smith the 31st. It gave Republicans their best shot to run against Jeff Smith, because if you look at this seat, you know, Jeff Smith, one, is more liberal in the district, and performed Tony Evers in 2022, and a little bit different seat. It's been redrawn a little bit since then. The seat's more Democratic than it was 4 years ago. So Jesse gave you an incumbent lawmaker who's raised money, law enforcement background, kind of like has his bipartisan reputation in the Capitol. He's worked on mental health issues, so a lot of good things for him to run against a Democrat in a slightly leaning Democratic district. Without James, though, you lose all those good things. Now, Michelle Skinner is running. She was a former TV and radio reporter. I think her career ended about 10 years ago. Did 10 years on WEAU in Eau Claire, but that was like in the 90s, which is ancient history, I know, for a lot of people. Ran for the Assembly in 2024. In that race, she got knocked for spending too much of her time, or her winters, in the South, and her campaign car had Georgia license plates. Not a great combination. Lost, she got like 48.3% of the vote in that district against Jody Emerson. She's now running, announced right after James announced he's not going to run. She got in with James's endorsement. It fed the perception I heard the last couple of weeks that James was basically making the decision before, but was waiting until he had somebody run in his place for the seat. So, okay, you got somebody, makes it tougher to beat Jeff Smith, as we sit here right now, right? But then now there are four seats in play this fall. Only one has an incumbent for Republicans, Howard Markline, over in Milwaukee suburbs. The fifth, Mike Roberts, small business owner from medical profession. He's running, looks like a good candidate on paper, but he's in like a +6 Kamala Harris seat that Robin Vining, a Democrat from Wauwatosa, is running in. Again, tough road to hoe there. Racine area kind of goes an L shape from Racine up to like the Milwaukee suburbs. Van Wongard announced he's not going to run again, retiring. That seat on the numbers is the best for Republicans, but they don't have a candidate. We're sitting, the window opened on Wednesday. They don't have a candidate right now announced. Trevor Jung is a former Racine alderperson who is also had their transit system, I believe. He's out there running. So now we have Howard. Traditionally, does been on the top of the ticket, great fundraiser, co-chair of the finance committee, not a great seat numbers-wise, but if you're looking for the best shot to win a seat, you go the incumbent, right? James retiring is a blow to Republicans trying to hold the Senate because of you've lost three incumbents now in swing seats. That is not great. Oh, by the way, some Republicans keep kind of saying, hey, we're your best bet donors, you should give money to us. And you look at the finance records, they are gravitating toward the Assembly Republicans, not Senate Republicans. Not going to make it any easier for them to make the pitch of we can hold the Senate when you're losing somebody like Jesse James as a candidate.
Right. Democrats are certainly trying to kind of use this as evidence that they already have the Senate as they kind of look towards that trifecta. A number of Assembly retirements we counted up. Let me do some quick math. 7 in the Assembly, 5 in the Senate, and then Democrats, there's a little bit of shifting as well as some in the Assembly run for Senate or governor, actually.
Yes.
So that brings us to a potential lawsuit that might be coming up. So a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. Supreme Court had this kind of major ruling on conversion therapy. So they ruled that a ban on conversion therapy in Colorado violates counselors' free speech rights. Now, we have a version of a conversion therapy ban on the books that is the result of that major change to rulemaking that happened last summer. It looks different than how the Colorado rule is written, or the Colorado law, excuse me. So the ban on conversion therapy in Colorado functions as like a ban on the practice, and here it functions as professional malpractice. And so when I did a story on it at the time, I spoke to an attorney from Will who said, that means that what is going on in Wisconsin is patently unconstitutional as decided by a majority on the Supreme Court, including liberal justices. And so it looks like they are going to sue. They alluded to this. They sent a letter earlier this week to the governor. But I'm really curious about this because the rule, again, functions about workplace misconduct. And other attorneys I have talked to have said, you don't get First Amendment protections on doing your job according to state, right? You couldn't be a builder who puts up a terrible roof and says, that was my artistic expression, so I have First Amendment protections, right? You have, like, building safety code. And so this is going to be really interesting to see play out both at the state level with this rule, and then also there's a number of lower-level ordinances in communities across the state. So what does this mean for the state?
We'll be in court again.
We will always be in court. I've been wondering about that lawsuit. The Will attorney I spoke to said, what if somebody files a lawsuit? And I thought, does that mean you? So that brings us to the stock report. Rising this week is gubernatorial candidate and Senator Kelda Royce.
So she got the WEAC endorsement, Wisconsin Education Association Council, I think it is. At one point, Wisconsin politics, this was like a huge get. This was like an 800-pound gorilla in Wisconsin politics. It's not anymore. Act 10 has weakened it in terms of like the finances and its, you know, membership roles. But still, it's a good get for Kelda, people argue to me, because before this, the conversation was, what's her path? Should she stay in? And that's kind of like been people talking about number of candidates, because if you think about this race in general, we know Mandela Barnes is a front runner. Whether he's the front runner is matter for debate. We know Sarah Rodriguez, Lieutenant Governor, she says she's got commitments for like $4 million in outside spending. The Democratic Lieutenant Governor Association says it's going to be $2 million for her. Okay, that gets you something. David Crowley, Mark County Executive, he raised more money than anybody else during the last period. Okay, that helps him a great deal. Francesca Hong has this buzz about her as, you know, this kind of really progressive candidate who's like really captured imagination online. But like a Joel Brennan, former DUA Secretary, Missy Hughes, former WEDIC secretary. Kelda, there's been like, where's your path? Because if you look at the poll, and now granted, Marquette poll has issues of getting a primary, you know, right at this point. They're not doing very well. Who's going to spend money for you? Well, now Kelda has WEAC to say, hey, I've got a path. At least to donors, I can raise money off of this. I'm the education candidate. Now, how powerful is WEAC, though, WEAC anymore? I looked at their finance report. They had $600K in the bank late March. Sounds like a lot. That's a week and a half of TV in Wisconsin, okay? Week and a half of TV in August is not great because voting begins before that. You need name ID. You need to build this. So who's going to help her build this? There's this kind of like misperception that WEAC was a big driver of Evers 1 in 2018. This is what happened. There was only one. WEAC actually didn't endorse Evers until after he won the primary. They didn't give him any money until after he won the primary. Look at the finance records. There was actually a 527 group which did an ad buy for Evers. They had education people involved. The treasurer was a former WEAC president from the 80s, but there wasn't a big WEAC push that got over the finish line. Now, it did help him. He ran for state superintendent before, and that helped build name ID, but they weren't a major player. What can they do for her now? The NEA is her parent union. That's the big money union for terms of like spending and races in Wisconsin. Asking people this week, I don't get the impression they think that the NEA will come in and spend money in primary because it's still a crowded primary. But they won't go across WEAC, so they'll probably just stay out of this thing. All comes down to, in the end then, who's going to have an outside group spending money for them and how much do they have to spend? Because if you don't have money, Barnes has the best name ID. Granted, not all of it's good, but when push comes to shove, he's still got the most. So how do you overtake that? And if you do get spending, what if Mandela gets his own spending? Like, how do you catch that? So watch for the next few months. There'll be these PACs that show up with really pleasant sounding names, like We Believe in Wisconsin's Tomorrow, you know, things like that. And then you start to see like stuff on Facebook, digital ads, maybe some mail, maybe some actual TV ads benefiting a candidate. That's what I'm watching for. Who has the outside help of that? Because if any of these guys, if a Brennan, a Hughes, Francesca, if they all get a big IE group, that's a huge boost. If they don't, we're all sitting twirling our thumbs about this race going, okay, when's it going to pop, you know?
And then mixed, we got, speaking of elections, we just ended the Supreme Court race a week ago, and now next year's Supreme Court election is off to a start. Lindsay Brunette has announced that she will be the liberal candidate for the court.
So what is the lesson to learn for liberals off of this past race? Now, we talked last week, the spending was so lopsided, maybe there isn't really a lesson to learn. But to some people, it's that you want a more liberal partisan candidate who's going to ignite the base, especially because we're not going to spend $115 million in a race, we don't think, anytime soon. This is going to be for either a 5-2 majority remaining for liberals or go to 6-1. So you need something that gauges the base. Or you go back to that kind of like tried and true model of female sitting judge and former prosecutor. If you like the latter, you like Lindsay Brunette. She is a elected judge in Clark County, which is not known for being very Democratic. Won as the DA in 2012 as a Democrat, again, in Ruby Red, Clark County. She's got all these things in spades that have worked before for Susan Crawford, Janet Prosewicz, Jill Karofsky, Rebecca Dallet. But again, do you want somebody like Chris Taylor? Taylor was not a prosecutor in her past lifetime. She, you know, she's a lawyer. She's a lawmaker. And people have said, hey, we like that. Some liberals, they also don't like the whole law and order thing because they want to talk more about social justice, not about like cracking down on things. They looked at Chris and go, hey, she had knocked on like law and order, so we can go that model. If you like that model, maybe Pedro Colon's your guy. Appeals court judge in Milwaukee, first Hispanic elected the legislature, I believe, appointed the Milwaukee County Circuit Court, then retained his seat and then won a spot or got in the first court, District Court of Appeals. So former Democratic lawmaker, like that might be your kind of path. People forget, though, that there is plenty of fodder on crime to use against Taylor. Lazardas didn't use it, and it was somewhat malpractice politically not to use it against her. I mean, she said a lot of things. Like, she's a lawmaker. They give a lot of speeches. Took a lot of votes. It wasn't there. So what I'm watching this race is, one, Pedro will get in at some point, probably the next few weeks. How does that develop? And then, two, you know, Brunette has the resume, but she doesn't have to raise money. You know, no offense to circuit court judges in Clark County, but that's not a big high-ticket money race, right? So she's got to build a big fundraising list to get, you know, pull money in. Now, I've seen the people working with her already. They're from the Taylor, Crawford, Prosewicz races. Like, the operatives are kind of gathering around her, so that's in her favor. For Republicans, conservatives, they're basically still finger-pointing at this point, going, like, it's your fault. No, it's your fault. So they're still disorganized. Don't forget, though, in 2017, Democrats were so demoralized from Trump winning in 16, they didn't bother to challenge Annette Ziegler in that Supreme Court race. A year after that, they won by 10 points, Rebecca Dallet. So things change in a heartbeat, but just keep an eye on this whole thing.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see who and if conservatives run a candidate. You know, Lindsay Brunette already kind of using some of the messaging that we are accustomed to of both sort of victims' rights and then also protecting personal health care, right? Which
What's personal health care? Yeah,
I couldn't imagine what that means. Falling this week, first congressional district, speaking of fundraising, Democrats.
So, look, if they're going to beat Brian Stile, it's likely not with the people they have right now running, unless the wave is so big, doesn't matter who you are, you just have to have a D after your name. And again, no offense to these guys, but look, looking financially, Brian Stile has $5.6 million in the bank, okay? The other folks were talking like, you know, barely six figures cash on hand. Not a great start. At the same time, Opportunity Wisconsin, which is a group, Democrat group, has been doing ads against Stile like all since like beginning of last year. They're up like 1.7 million. They're waiting for somebody to come in and run who's maybe better, I guess is the word you would use, more connected, a little bit better able to raise money, whatever. So we're watching for that person. Now, if I were you, I'd read the West Politics report this afternoon to find out who that person might be. There might be somebody kind of poking around, but the current field, just not getting it done. And Brian Stile, when the Democrats is, he has so much money, they're thinking about 2028 already. Ron Johnson says he's going to run again for another term. If Ron Johnson doesn't run, Brian Stile could have a nice bank account to go in there and run for U.S. Senate, and you'd have a hard time kind of like catching him financially in that situation. So they're looking for anybody to please beat Brian style, at least make life difficult for him.
Well, it looks like you just plugged a little bit of a scoop, and that will wrap us up for this week. I am Anyavan Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, Your Week in Review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.